This is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome you to our online course, Basal Bolus Therapy, Getting Glucose to Goal in the Hospital Setting. In the past few years, there's been a tremendous movement in the inpatient side to get blood sugars closer to the goal set for the outpatient setting. Many hospitals are now going to basal bolus therapy to help achieve glucose goals. This online course will review the new basal bolus guidelines, and we'll also look at particular case studies to help apply the information learned. So, let's get started. Basal Bolus Therapy online course is accredited for registered nurses and California pharmacists for 2 CE units and 1.5 CEs for registered dietitians. Throughout this online course, you will see yellow underlines. When you see a word that's underlined in yellow, click on them to review additional information and resources. For example, if you click here, there is a complete listing of articles and resources specifically designed for this course on hospitals and hyperglycemia. The objectives for this course, Basal Bolus Therapy, Getting Glucose to Goal in the Hospital, are as follows. We'll be discussing the importance of inpatient glucose control. 10 years ago, we weren't even discussing the importance of glucose in the hospital setting, but a lot of great research has emerged supporting that glucose control in the hospital improves outcomes not only during the inpatient stay, but after discharge. We'll be looking at the goals of care in the inpatient setting, and we'll spend a lot of time on this objective, looking at basal bolus insulin therapy, how to determine the right dose for the right patient, and looking at correction scales, and also adjusting for hyper and hypoglycemia. We'll look at situations that occur in hospitals and how to adjust insulin therapy based on a variety of situations that come up frequently in the hospital setting. Certainly we know that hyperglycemia in an inpatient setting warrants our attention. More than just revealing diabetes, hyperglycemia indicates to us that the patient is in a stressed state. Many people who enter the hospital without diabetes may become hyperglycemic during their hospital stay. This hyperglycemia may resolve, or they may just have expressed undiagnosed diabetes. But regardless whether they had undiagnosed diabetes and they are hyperglycemic in the hospital, or if they have diabetes and their blood sugars are elevated during the hospital stay, elevated blood sugar levels warrant our attention in the hospital because they're triggering to us that the body is out of balance and action is required. Continuing that thought, what is the big deal between hospitals and hyperglycemia? Why does it matter if patient's blood sugar is elevated? We definitely know a few things. And one thing is that hyperglycemia is associated with increased morbidity and mortality. And this is associated with increased inflammation in the blood vessels. High blood sugars indicate inflammation, insulin resistance, and tell us overall the systems are out of balance. We definitely know that people with diabetes and hyperglycemia in the hospital setting are at higher risk for clots. Because of that elevated blood sugar, the blood is more thick and gooey. There's more a likelihood of clot formation leading to stroke, and also leading to infection. When there's high levels of sugar in the blood, the white blood cells don't work as well, increasing risk of infection, and especially in our immunosuppressed patients. Definitely people with diabetes and hyperglycemia have longer lengths of stay. And this is going to impact a lot as far as the care they receive and the cost to our medical system. So hyperglycemia is a big deal. And many organizations now, as they come through and inspect hospitals, are looking at how we manage blood sugars in the hospital setting because they know it impacts outcomes. Patients who enter the hospital are in a stress situation. There's stress, of course, emotionally, but what I'm really focusing on now is the physical stress. And many times that stress causes the hyperglycemia. So as we've mentioned, they could not have diabetes and become hyperglycemic during the hospital stay, and then we've just revealed they do actually have diabetes. Or if they already have diabetes, their blood sugar levels can elevate dramatically. When the body is expressing hyperglycemia, other things happen. there's a decrease in the effectiveness of the white blood cells. White blood cells don't work good to fight off infection in a hyperglycemic environment. When the blood sugars are above 200, the body enters a state of catabolism where it has to use alternate energy sources like muscle and fat for fuel. And when patients are hospitalized, their metabolic needs go up. We don't want to deprive them of the fuel that they need. Hyperglycemia is associated with increased inflammation. So we'll have vascular inflammation and we'll have endothelial cell dysfunction and increased risk for clotting due to that increased blood viscosity. This all leads to increased blood pressure, pulse, longer lengths of stay, increases mortality, and certainly has an impact on morbidity. This slide is by Dr. Umpieres, who's done a lot of great work in the inpatient setting looking at the relationship between outcomes and hyperglycemia. As you look at this pie graph, you'll see that 62% of patients do not have hyperglycemia. Their blood sugars are normal. And this is an interesting point because you could say, well, people who enter the hospital and they're sick and they're stressed out, of course their blood sugars go up. But you can see that's not true at all. 62% of people admitted to hospitals who are very sick are able to maintain normal blood sugars. This tells us that their pancreases are working well. They have good functioning pancreases who can handle the stress. I want to point out another number here. 26% of patients admitted to the hospital have known diabetes. So we know, we can look at their admission sheet and their HMP. They're well known to us to have diabetes. And actually, they tend to do fairly well because they get treated. Their hyperglycemia is treated and they're more likely to have better outcomes in the hospital setting compared to their counterparts. There's 12% who are admitted to the hospital, have no diagnosis of diabetes in any of their HMP or previous histories, yet when they walk into the hospital, their blood sugars meet the criteria for diabetes. And this group of patients, this 12% who has undiagnosed or undetected hyperglycemia, actually has the worst outcomes because many times they're undertreated. So if you're working in the hospital setting, I would say these two groups of patients who are experiencing hyperglycemia really deserve our attention and deserve basal bolus therapy to get their blood sugars to goal, decrease inflammation, and improve outcomes. This slide is a continuation of the previous graph. What they did in this study is they looked at the medical records of 2,030 consecutive adult patients admitted to the hospital. And they were analyzed for the presence of hyperglycemia, and then they tracked their outcomes. So let's take a look at this first one. This looks at hospital mortality. Now, the pink is patients with normal blood sugars. The blue are patients with known diabetes, and this pink-violet area is new hyperglycemia. You can see, if you look at overall mortality, the ones with new hyperglycemia not previously diagnosed had the worst outcomes. This is true for the non-ICU setting and also very true for the ICU setting. So again, this is showing us that hyperglycemia really indicates to us this person is in a stress state, their metabolic systems are out of balance, they have more inflammation going on, and they really benefit from blood glucose control. So now that we've established that glucose control is critical in the hospital setting, what are we looking for? What equals above normal blood sugars that should alert us to something's not quite right? Well, the first category is called prediabetes. This is a fasting glucose of 100 to 125, or if we look at their 3-month average, known as the A1C, that number is ranging between 5.7 to 6.4. Now, certainly this is not life-threatening, but if we get a chem panel back and we're looking at this patient's labs and we see their fasting glucose is in this range, we know that under stress, their pancreas cannot rise to the challenge. We know that they might be marching toward diabetes, and we should share this information with them and make them aware that their blood sugars are higher than normal in the hospital setting. We'll talk about in a minute what number triggers action on our part. But diabetes is a little bit past prediabetes as far as the numbers are higher. To be diagnosed with diabetes, you need a fasting glucose of 126 or greater. And this has to be repeated on a separate occasion or a random glucose of 200 or greater, A1C 6.5. This is the diagnostic criteria for diabetes. And this diagnostic criteria applies for patients in the inpatient setting or outpatient setting. It doesn't differentiate between when you're sick and when you're well. If your pancreas can't handle the work and the blood sugars are higher than these ranges, it equals diabetes. But this is a really important point to make too. And this is from Dr. Umpierdes and his colleagues that say any patient with a blood glucose 140 or above requires treatment. It doesn't specify fasting or non-fasting. If we identify a patient in the hospital with a blood sugar of 140, we need to take action. It's higher than normal, and this person would benefit from insulin therapy. So we're going to bring it to the provider's attention and let them know that this patient is hyperglycemic. This chart is very helpful in understanding the relationship between A1C and what it means as far as estimated average glucose. As I mentioned, the A1C is a 3-month average of the blood glucose levels in that person. So if a person comes in and their fasting blood sugar is 212, it's so helpful to get an A1C to see, is this a new onset hyperglycemia? Or maybe they'll come in and their A1C is 9%, which means the average blood sugar of 212. This patient, we know now, has had hyperglycemia for the past 3 months or longer. So this diabetes has been around for a while. But what if a patient comes in, their blood sugar is 212, we draw an A1C, and it's closer to 6%? Well, we could say this would be a new evolving hyperglycemia. So based on this information, our treatment plan might vary a little bit, and it might influence our insulin dosing strategy that we'll talk about later. So getting that fasting blood sugar and the A1C together will really help us make the best plan for that patient and also gives us a feeling of the history of their diabetes. In 2009, the American College of Endocrinology and the American Diabetes Association convened a task force. And this task force was charged to say, based on the evidence, and this is all evidence-based information, what is the best way to manage inpatient hyperglycemia? And so what they said, for patients in the hospital setting, insulin is the recommended therapy. Insulin lowers blood sugars. Maybe it helps decrease inflammation. There's flexibility with insulin. We can adjust the dose. And insulin always works to get blood sugars down. They recommended that oral diabetes medications not be used in the inpatient setting. Once a person takes a pill, it's going to be in their body for a long time. They might have to go to surgery. They might have kidney problems. So those medications may not be being cleared very effectively. So basically what they're saying is start patients on insulin. In the ICU situation, IV insulin is a preferred therapy for critically ill patients, patients undergoing CABG surgery. Patients who are NPO with hyperglycemia, IV insulin is a preferred method. But for non-critically ill patients, we're going to utilize sub-Q insulin therapy. And during this online course, we'll be discussing how to determine dosing for insulin and administration of the appropriate doses, correction factors, and basal bolus. Managing hyperglycemia and diabetes in the hospital setting looks like this. In the non-ICU setting, we're going to utilize basal bolus therapy. And basal bolus therapy, all it really means is a combination of basal or long-acting insulin and bolus, which is rapid or fast-acting insulin. And this might be MPH and regular, or it might be long-acting like glargine or Levemir, and a rapid-acting insulin combined, which would be the Novolog, Humalog, or Apidra. Or it might be a premixed insulin that combines basal bolus. In the ICU and critical care setting, we've mentioned this earlier, insulin drips are preferred, especially if the patient is NPO, they're very hyperglycemic, they're unstable. But if the patient's eating and more stable, we would also move them to basal bolus in the ICU and critical care setting. So what are the goals for treatment for our hospitalized patients? Well, for critically ill patients, we're going to start insulin therapy no later than a blood glucose of 180. And once the insulin is started, the goal is to achieve blood glucose levels of 140 to 180. And we've mentioned this already. Insulin drip is a preferred treatment. For our non-critically ill patients, once that blood sugar is 140 or greater, our goals are as follows. Pre-meal less than 140 and post-meal less than 180. And again, basal bolus insulin is a preferred treatment. A patient comes in for a urinary tract infection, and we look at their CAM panel. They've got high blood glucose levels, and we tell the patient, well, we need to start you on insulin. And the patient may say to us, well, I came in here for a bladder infection, and now you gave me diabetes. A lot of patients have resistance against insulin. They have a lot of thoughts about insulin, what insulin can do. They knew somebody on insulin and they died. So there's a lot of fear and there may be a lot of resistance to starting insulin. So as we go through this course, we're going to be talking a lot of how do we share with patients the benefits of insulin, that insulin is the ultimate hormone replacement therapy. It will bring your blood sugars down. And just because you're on it in the hospital doesn't mean you're on it for life. But it is a best strategy that we have to immediately bring down your blood glucose levels so your body can get back into balance and we can get rid of that bladder infection. Because as you know, if there's a lot of sugar in the blood, there's a lot of sugar in the bladder, and that's going to feed the bacteria. So we're going to always, you know, promote insulin as an excellent strategy to lower blood glucose levels and maybe temporary, and hopefully your blood sugars will normalize during your hospital stay. But we're just going to start you at this and keep problem solving. Speaking about the miracle of insulin, before 1922, insulin was not available, and many children with type 1 diabetes were very malnourished and just struggling for life. Now, in February 1923, this same little boy in this picture went to Banting and Best in Toronto, Canada, and received insulin therapy. And you can see within a 2-month time frame how much better this child looked. He doesn't look much happier, but certainly if you look at his face, he's got the chubby cheeks. He's no longer failure to thrive. He has fat stored. So when I'm thinking about insulin and patients resisting it, I always think of this picture and how remarkable of a hormone insulin is at helping us store nutrition, store energy, store calories, and help get that blood glucose level to normal. When we think about people with hyperglycemia in the hospital, we kind of have two different categorizations, type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And patients with type 1 diabetes, since they make no insulin at all whatsoever, have different needs than our patients with type 2. Type 1s are not insulin resistant, but they make no insulin, so we have to replace the insulin they're not making. And let's just take a look at this case study. We have a 43-year-old admitted to evaluate angina pain, and his morning blood sugar is 142. You walk in with his insulin dose, and the patient says to you, I will bottom out if I take that much insulin. What are we going to say to the patient? Well, a person with type 1 diabetes really has a tremendous amount of expertise in their diabetes, in their blood sugar, in their insulin management. In this situation, if a patient said that to me, I would definitely say, okay, tell me how much insulin you would normally take for a blood sugar of 142, considering what you're going to eat for breakfast or lunch. And that patient would then tell me, maybe he only takes, you know, 4 units instead of the 8 you have in the insulin syringe. So that would just mean we contact the provider, ask the patient what their normal insulin requirements are at home, and imitate that in the hospital setting. So I think this is really important for our patients with type 1 so they get the care that they need. What if you walk into the room with the insulin syringe of 2 units of insulin and the patient says, hey, that's not even going to touch my blood sugar? Again, I'm going to believe it. This person with type 1 has been living with it for many, many years, maybe 30 years for this gentleman, and he absolutely has a good handle on how insulin affects his blood sugar. So again, I would, you know, approach him and ask him, tell me your usual insulin dose, share that with a provider, and see if we can't implement that in the hospital setting. However, most of the patients we'll be dealing with will have a situation more similar to Mrs. Jones. She's 62 years old, a little heavy, and complains of feeling tired, urinating several times a night. She comes in, she has a urinary tract infection. Her white count, 12.3, her glucose, 237. She has high blood pressure and a history of gestational diabetes, but no ketones in her urine. This is a very typical presentation of type 2 diabetes. She probably had it for a while. The urinary tract infection tells me she probably has a lot of glucose in her bladder and her bacteria are just thriving in that. What risk factors does she have for diabetes? So let's just look at risk factors. She's 62. She's heavy. She's hypertensive. And she has gestational diabetes. What are her signs of diabetes? Well, those are pretty obvious. feeling tired, urinating a lot. Definitely a UTI is a sign of diabetes. Any unexplained infection, I think diabetes. Blood sugar of 237, that equals the criteria for diabetes. Random blood sugar 200 or greater. And since she has no ketones in her urine and her blood sugars aren't wildly high, and given her age, we're going to say she has type 2 diabetes. So we know that with type 2 diabetes, she's making some insulin, but not enough to keep her blood sugars at goal range or at target range. So her pancreas maybe only has 20 to 30% left of its normal beta cell insulin producing capacity. And we also know, in addition to making less insulin, she's resistant to it. And because of her weight, that tells us she also will be resistant to insulin. So this situation is a more common one. A person with insulin resistance and insulin deprivation, because their pancreas is making less of it, and they will definitely need insulin therapy in this situation to get blood sugars down. But they'll need a different type of insulin therapy than our type 1. And we'll go over that as we go through this online course. So I think I've already answered this question. How would we manage her blood glucose in the hospital? We're going to give her insulin. We're going to use basal bolus therapy. And Mrs. Jones is going to feel probably upset about this. I came in for a bladder infection and now you have me on insulin. So a lot of teaching and discussion is going to go into this insulin therapy and reassuring her. Hopefully it's a temporary measure to get your blood sugars under control. If we look at the 24-hour physiologic profile of insulin, I think it's very helpful in understanding how we use basal bolus therapy. Well, first of all, you have the basal glucose down here. Now, basal glucose really is important because it gives us the energy we need in between lunch, dinner, in between meals, and through the night. We get our basal glucose from the liver and from our muscle. That's where we're going to get that energy when we're not eating. But to keep that basal glucose in check, we need basal insulin. So our little pancreas pumps out about 0.5 units of insulin per hour, just a little bit to keep the blood sugars from going too high. If you don't have a working pancreas, or your pancreas is not able to do its job effectively, we'll have to replace basal insulin through insulin injections. And those basal insulins, as I've mentioned before, would include the insulins MPH, Levemir, and Lantus. Those basal insulins will help control in between meal blood sugars and through the night. And the efficacy of this basal insulin is reflected in the morning blood sugar. Now, what about when we eat? You can see here, every time we eat, we get a spike in blood sugar. This person does not have diabetes, so their post-meal blood sugar never goes above 140. But in order to get that mealtime glucose to goal range, we need bolus insulin. So here is the pancreas's normal job to release a little bit of insulin to cover food. And you can see the pancreas is so prescribed in the way it releases insulin. I mean, it knows exactly how much insulin to release to cover that food bolus. But in the hospital setting, we're going to use insulin to imitate what the pancreas would do. And the bolus insulins we might use include the Novolog, Humalog, Apidra, or regular insulin. And that's why you'll see we give fast-acting insulin at every meal to cover these mealtime spikes, and we'll give basal insulin at night or sometimes in the morning to cover the in-between meals and through the night blood sugars. And this is really, in a nutshell, basal bolus therapy. Thinking like a pancreas. A pancreas would normally give a squirt of insulin every time you eat. It would give a little bit extra if you're hyperglycemic. And the pancreas is going to release insulin 0.5 units an hour just to keep in-between meals and through the night blood sugars under control. Let's talk a little bit more about basal bolus insulin. I consider basal and bolus insulin the insulin action team. The bolus insulin is responsible for getting the blood sugars down after the meal. It includes the rapid-acting insulins, aspart, lispro, glulysine. These are the analogs that get in really fast, 5 to 15 minutes, and hang out for about 4 hours. Our old standby, short-acting regular insulin, takes a little bit longer to kick in, about a half an hour, but it's going to last longer, 4 to 6 hours. The other insulin that we have discussed is the basal insulin, which controls between the meals and through the night blood sugars. And there we have intermediate, which is MPH, lasting for about a half a day. MPH has more of an onset and peak action around 4 to 10 hours, as opposed to the longer acting new insulin analogs, Detemir and Glargine, which lasts for about 24 hours. I consider these two the insulin action teams, the bolus being the rabbit, gets in, does his job, hops back out, and the basal more like the turtle, in no particular rush to get in, hangs out for half a day to a day, and then meanders out. So in order to get glucose levels to goal, we have to imitate the pancreas through basal and bolus insulin therapy. Bolus insulin is about half our daily dose of insulin, divided by 3 meals. And you can see here, the onset of these insulins is really quick. So for the analogs, the Humalog, Novolog, Apidra, it's going to start working in 5 to 15 minutes. And what that tells me is we cannot give that insulin until the meal tray is there. We can't give insulin until we know the person is going to have food available to them. Regular insulin takes a little bit longer to start working, but still, we wouldn't give regular insulin unless we knew there was going to be a food source coming in. Insulin has to work with food, more specifically, carbohydrates, starches, things that, you know, raise the blood sugar to be effective and not cause the blood sugar to go too low. And, you know, we give these bolus insulins usually every 4 to 6 hours because they last for about 4 to 6 hours. So we give it at each meal. Some patients who are MPO, we may give every Q6 hours or who are on tube feeding, but for our patients who are eating meals, we'll give this bolus insulin with each meal. So just a summary slide. These insulins, bolus, gets in fast, gets out fast. How do we know how well it's working? Well, we can look at the post-meal blood glucose, and we definitely know that this insulin is designed, bolus insulin is designed to cover food or hyperglycemia. And just a kind of a general rule of thumb, 1 unit of bolus insulin covers about 15 grams of carb. And I'll tell you, in a hospital setting, if you're using consistent carbohydrate meals, for example, those meals usually have around 45 to 60 grams of carb. So in general, you could say that just to cover food, patients will need about 3 to 4 units of insulin. And if their blood sugars are elevated, we're going to add a correction scale, because we know the correction scale will help fix hyperglycemia. And generally speaking, 1 unit of insulin drops blood sugar 30 to 50 points. So we're going to give bolus insulin to cover food. We're going to give bolus insulin to correct for hyperglycemia. And we're going to add those two up and give it before the meal. If we think about how is the effectiveness of bolus insulin determined, in the hospital setting, we're going to use before next meal blood glucose. For example, if I gave Novolog insulin before breakfast, which is a bolus insulin, I'm going to use my pre-lunch blood sugar to see if that was enough insulin. And my pre-lunch blood sugar should be 70 to 140. When I give that pre-lunch insulin, the Apidra, for example, I'm going to look at my pre-dinner blood sugar to see how well that Apidra worked before lunch. And my before-dinner blood sugar should be here, 70 to 140. If my pre-meal blood sugar is less than 70, I know that person is getting too much insulin. We're going to need to contact the doctor and make some adjustments. If it's running higher than 140, maybe we're not giving enough. So this is a very important range to keep in mind. The goal for before meals is 70 to 140. The one time we check blood sugars after a meal is usually bedtime. Our HS blood sugar check is usually about 2 to 3 hours after dinner. We have a different goal for that blood sugar. It should be less than 180. But I want to add one more number to this. Patients should really not go to sleep if their blood sugar is less than 100. If it's less than 100, we want to give them a snack and maybe for the next night, cut back on their dinner bolus insulin so that's not, their blood sugar isn't so low before they go to sleep. We always want to prevent nighttime hypoglycemia. So The 1 to 2 hour post-meal blood sugar, the HS or nighttime blood sugar, should be less than 180, but really also greater than 100. And if it's not, we can make some changes in insulin and make sure to give a snack. This summary slide just covers what we've covered in a different way. As far as the bolus insulin, it covers carbohydrates, or another word we use is prandial or mealtime coverage. It matches the insulin to the carbohydrates, and as we've mentioned, you get 1 unit for every 15 grams. And since a usual meal is about 45 to 60 grams, that equals 3 to 4 units of insulin. In addition to prandial coverage or food coverage, we're going to give a correction bolus. Let's say our target is 150. That's the goal for this patient. And their before meal blood sugar is 200. So we're going to add extra insulin to get their blood sugar to target range in addition to the mealtime coverage. So we would add perhaps 1 unit for correction plus the 3 to 4 units for food, equaling 4 to 5 units for that particular meal. And very, very importantly, we adjust ratios depending on sensitivity and response. So if we have a patient on a certain correction scale and they're getting a lot of low blood sugars below 70s, or actually even if they're getting one low blood sugar, we are going to reevaluate and see, is this too aggressive of an insulin scale? On the other hand, if their blood sugars are consistently above 200, that gives us a signal too, that this is not a matching insulin scale for them. We need to take action to fix it. So, and you'll notice during patients' hospital stay, if they're very sick or very infected, they may need more insulin. And as they heal and recover and get antibiotic therapy, they may need less insulin. So this is a very dynamic process that requires our vigilance. As we know, in hospital settings, things don't always go according to schedule. We get distracted, things happen, there's emergencies. I mean, we're always trying to juggle all the different needs of our patients, our colleagues. So things are going to happen around insulin therapy. And we understand that and we acknowledge that. So what I'd like to do is some problem solving with you. When things don't go as planned, what's our backup plan? So let's just say this. Now, I'm focusing right now on the bolus insulin, the fast-acting insulin, situations around that. The nurse had an emergency, and patient already ate lunch. So the nurse was getting the insulin. Something happened. She ran off. She came back. The patient said, oh, that was a great lunch, and she didn't give the insulin. What should she do now? Yes, we still need to give the insulin so we can... If it's within a half hour of that patient eating lunch, let's go ahead and give the usual amount of insulin. If more time has passed than that, we're going to have to do some critical thinking, reevaluate their blood sugars, see what their blood sugars are running at that moment, and we might have to make some dose adjustments. So it gets more complicated the longer time has passed. But if it's just within a half hour of that patient eating, you can feel very comfortable going ahead and giving the insulin that you had already drawn up for that patient. Let's take a look at a different example. Nurse administered insulin and patient only ate a few bites of turkey and drank non-sugar iced tea. That's a problem. So you gave the patient 5 units of fast-acting insulin, bolus insulin. And we know that in order for insulin to work right and not cause hypoglycemia, that insulin needs to interact with carbohydrate, with starch. And the foods I have listed here, turkey, protein, it will not raise the blood sugar. Non-sugar tea, no caloric, no energy in that drink, no calories in it. That will not raise the blood sugar. So we know we've given a patient insulin and there's no carbohydrate and no starch to interact with that insulin. So if that patient is at high risk for low blood sugar, what action do we take? Well, we're going to get some juice. We're going to find, ask the patient, is there anything I can get you to drink? Maybe you have some ice cream in the freezer. We can get him some ice cream, some pudding, a yogurt. We need to do some fast thinking and get that patient some carbohydrate on board to prevent hypoglycemia. Okay, one more question. What if the patient's vomiting? They're nauseated. They really are not able to eat. Then we're going to have to make sure they have an IV going in with some D5. They need some dextrose on board. They may even need some D10 if they took a large amount of insulin and they have no food to interact with that insulin. And I just want to reassure you that a full bag of D5 only has 120 calories, so you're not going to push them into DKA. And we're going to definitely monitor this patient more frequently to identify if they're getting low blood sugar. Make sure this patient knows the signs of low blood sugar to alert us in case they're low. And if they're able to eat, have some juice or some sugar-containing beverage or food next to their on their table by their bed. This is very, very important because if we don't take some action, this patient will get hypoglycemia, and we want to avoid that. It's very dangerous. Okay, next one. You just gave 3 units of Novolog. Novolog is a bolus insulin, fast-acting, and patient needs to go to OR now. Same situation. You've given the insulin. The patient was about to eat. They made him MPO. No glucose going in. No fuel going in. What are we going to do? I think the answer is pretty obvious. We've got to get a bag of D5 or D10 up there. Let the OR team know. They're going to have to monitor the blood sugar frequently, and this patient might even need a D50 IV push. So this is really, these situations come up all the time in hospital settings, and it requires a little critical thinking. But if you know the basics that you need, if you're going to give insulin, there has to be carbohydrate or glucose to interact with that to prevent hypoglycemia. That might help. And even if the patient's already eaten food, they need the insulin. If we skip the insulin, their blood sugar is going to go very high before the next meal. So some action needs to be taken. And of course, all of this is discussed with the physician as we go through these different case scenarios. But sometimes we just need to take action immediately to make sure that patient is safe. Okay, well now we've covered food. We haven't talked about hyperglycemia. What if that blood glucose is greater than 150? Well, that's where the correction bolus comes into play. The prandial covers the food. The correction covers for that hyperglycemia. In addition to the prandial insulin, we're going to add a correction bolus. And this is a typical correction bolus, which you can see if the blood sugars are less than 70, we actually treat for hypoglycemia and hold the insulin dose. If the blood sugars are 71 to 150, we add no additional insulin on top of the prandial dose. But starting at 151, this scale says let's add 1 unit for every 50 points above 150. So you can see in 50 unit increments, as you go up, you add an additional unit of insulin. And this is a very mild and typical correction bolus that would treat hyperglycemia. We'll look at some hospital-specific correction boluses that you'll be using in your facility in the upcoming slides. I'd like to move on to basal insulin. Basal insulin is the other half of this equation. It's the long-acting insulin that covers blood sugar in between meals and through the night. It's the other half of the total daily dose of insulin. MPH is our old-fashioned standby, and you can see MPH is usually dosed twice a day because it only lasts for about 10 to 16 hours. It does have a peak action, 4 to 10 hours, so we know that the person is at more risk for hypoglycemia during that 4 to 10 hour time period. Our longer acting insulin analogs, Denimer and Glargine, have no peak, so they have less risk of hypoglycemia because they have a gradual steady state in the body. But you can see they last a lot longer. Denimer, some people can take it once a day and get adequate coverage, but many people need it twice a day. Lantus, same thing, most people do well once a day coverage, but some people may need the Lantus twice a day. And most institutions default to giving these long-acting insulins at the bedtime hour. But if your patients are having trouble with nocturnal or nighttime low blood sugar, we can certainly talk to the provider and see if giving these insulins in the morning might be a better approach. When I think about basal insulin, I think about it as the turtle of the insulin world. That is, it's in no particular rush to get in. It hangs out for half a day to a day, and it just slowly wanders out. How do we know how well the basal insulin is working? Well, we look at the fasting blood sugar. So if we gave the patient 20 units of Lantus the night before, and we wake up and their blood sugar's 62, that's too much Lantus at night. If we give them Lantus and they wake up in the morning and their blood sugar's 118, that's just the right amount of Lantus. And if they wake up and their blood sugar is 210, not enough. So that fasting blood sugar reflects what happened the night before, and if we gave enough or too much or just the right amount of basal insulin. We also have formulations of combination sub-Q insulin. There's a Humalog mix, and when you see these mixes, they come in ratios. And the first number, 75, represents a percentage, which means 75% of this mixture is long-acting insulin, or NPL, which is long-acting lispro. The other 25% is the fast-acting or rapid-acting insulin, lispro. So if I was to give a patient 100 units of 75-25, I know that 75 units would be the long-acting, and the other 25 are the quick-acting insulin. So they're pre-mixed and a standardized ratio. The same for all of these. Here we have our old standby MPH and regular, 70-30, 70% MPH, 30% regular. We might see these used in the hospitals if patients are on tube feedings or they come in with on the 70-30 insulin. It's very easy to dose, and a lot of patients with just hyperglycemia and type 2 diabetes do very well on these insulins. They're easy to administer at home. You give it once or twice a day. You can adjust the dose over time to get the patient closer to its target range. So these insulins are used and they can be very effective. The major drawback of them is you can't fine-tune therapy because they're in a ratio that doesn't change. They're in a constant state, so you can't adjust the fast-acting and keep the basal the same. So it has limitations that way, but for people with what I call global hyperglycemia, these premixed insulins work very nice, and for people on tube feedings too. And some people on steroids do really well with these because people on steroids tend to get high blood sugar between lunch and dinner time. So giving this 70-30 in the morning can really help combat that late afternoon hyperglycemia. So insulin therapy components. We have basal insulin. It's a long-acting insulin that covers between meals and through the night. We have prandial or meal insulin. It's a bolus insulin that covers food, IV dextrose, enteral nutrition, TPN, or other nutritional supplements. So it could be food you take by mouth or food that's coming in through a vein or a tube. It can help cover that carbohydrate ingestion. We have correction insulin. That is bolus insulin dosed to correct for hyperglycemia. That happens in spite of the use of basal and nutritional insulin. This correctional insulin is usually given before meals and combined with the prandial insulin. So these are the words that we're using. Here's a definition of these terms. And you'll see as we go through this, we're going to be applying these concepts to different situations. So how much insulin does a patient need? Well, it depends on a lot of different factors. Their body weight is probably one of the biggest ones. People who are overweight need more insulin. This is because they tend to be more insulin resistant, and also because we base insulin on body weight. A thinner person's going to need a lot less insulin, so we're always very conservative with thin people because usually they make less insulin or no insulin, and they're not resistant to it, so that they just need replacement of the insulin they're not making. Our patients who are frail and elderly, another group of patients we're very cautious about. Older patients tend to have poor kidney function, especially our frail older patients. They may not be eating as well. And those two factors together will increase their risk for hypoglycemia, especially if their kidney function is diminishing and their creatinine is greater than 1.4. We know that old insulin and medications are being cleared more slowly by their body, so they may have a longer half-life, increasing the risk of hypoglycemia. What about the eating status? Well, if our patients are eating normally and they're hungry, that's great because we know that the insulin can interact with the food. But what if they're nauseated, poor, you know, PO intake, or their MPO, or they're just having like a lot of variation in their ability to eat? That causes more of a challenge for us. So we may have to be creative in our insulin dosing, and maybe we give insulin after they eat and after we've seen that they can hold down their food. The types of diabetes, as I've mentioned, are type 1s are more insulin sensitive, and we're doing a little bit different type of insulin replacement versus our type 2s or patients who are on steroids and have very high levels of blood sugar. We may need to give them a little bit additional insulin because of their resistance. And patients who are infected or septic tend to be very insulin resistant, need high doses of insulin. But as I've mentioned earlier, as they move toward recovery, as their infection clears, we may see a sudden dramatic drop in their insulin needs. So we're always keeping a very close eye on that. And on the other hand, if the patient's septic and they're moving into renal failure, they may need less insulin. So all of these different factors go into play as we're figuring out the dose of insulin and over time seeing if adjustments in insulin are required. Okay, so how do we initiate insulin in the hospital? What we're going to do, number one, is stop oral agents, and we're going to get the patient's weight and we're going to translate it to kilograms. In insulin dosing world, most of the dosing strategies are based in kilograms, so that's what we're going to use. And it's approximately, you just divide the pounds of weight in half, or by 2.2. And then we're going to do is calculate the total insulin daily dose. And that is just TDD, total daily dose required. And generally speaking, patients need about 0.3 to 0.7 units of insulin per kilogram per day. And we could just, you know, use a ballpark and say they need about 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day. So if you have a patient who weighs 100 kilograms, you say 100 times 0.5, they would need about 50 units a day. Then we're going to choose a dosing schedule. And we're going to say 50% of total daily dose is basal insulin, and 50% of their total daily dose is prandial or nutritional insulin, just what I was talking about earlier. Half of the insulin is basal, half of the insulin is bolus of their total insulin needs. So if he was getting 100 units a day, 50 units of basal and 50 units of bolus. And of course, the nutritional or bolus insulin would be divided by the three meals. Now, on top of the basal and bolus, we're going to have to use correction insulin to treat blood sugars above goal. And this will be based on the results of the blood glucose levels and what correction scale was chosen for this patient. And of course, we're going to have to be flexible looking at their MPO status, their eating status, or any other clinical changes. Let's move on to talk about calculating total daily dose. That is, how much insulin does a patient need a day? And we're going to base it on a few things. There's going to be a lot of clinical judgment. We're going to look at the history. We're going to talk to the patient. We're going to assess the situation. And this is usually determined by the provider. However, those of us involved in diabetes education or supporting the providers are going to have input into this also. So if a patient is insulin naive, this is very important. If a patient comes in, never been diagnosed with diabetes, a new hyperglycemia, never taken insulin, we're always going to err on the side of very conservative insulin therapy. So if they're insulin naive, frail, thin, elderly, eating, you know, very poorly, less than 50%, or very unpredictable in their eating, or if they have any hepatic or renal insufficiency, we're going to go very conservative, err on the side of too low of dose of insulin. Because when people have renal insufficiency, they're at high risk for low blood sugar. So their total insulin daily dose will be 0.3 units of insulin per kilogram per day. And we'll have some case studies to apply this information. Now let's just go on to the next one. The moderate total daily dose is 0.4 to about 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day. Now, these are not written in stone. This is based on clinical judgment. There's lots of papers out there discussing this. So there's no one right way of doing this, but these are just some general guidelines. But for a patient who's average or overweight, good PO intake, and maybe they have type 1 diabetes, this is a good place to start. If you're not quite sure, you might want to go lower, 0.4 units of insulin per kilogram per day. But if they seem like they're in pretty good shape and, you know, they're healthy, their kidneys are working good, they're eating well, we can certainly consider 0.5 units, especially if they're on the heavy side. Now, for this group of patients who are insulin resistant, we're going to go at a higher dose. This is for the patients who are obese, morbidly obese. Maybe they're on steroids. Maybe they have a horrible raging infection. They probably have had diabetes for a while, have been on insulin. So these patients can be very insulin resistant, and we might even go higher than this. But in general, a high level of insulin is 0.6 to 0.7 units of insulin per kilogram per day. The other thing I definitely want to mention here is we're going to ask the patient, tell me what your usual dose is at home. Because many times continuing the dose they are at home is a good place to start. And then we can add the correction scale on top of that to treat hyperglycemia. So this is a really, we're going to ask the patient, find out where they're at. We're going to, you know, do that great assessment. And based on the information we gather, we're going to start them at low, moderate, or resistant. And if we're not sure, maybe the patient is non-communicative, we don't have a good history, we always start more conservative because we can always increase. But if you give too much insulin, it's a little bit more difficult to backpedal because once you inject it, it's in there. So I'm always, you know, advocating err on the side of conservative therapy, start low, gradually increase. Because in the hospital setting, the great thing is the patient's there with us, we can watch them closely, we can increase rapidly. So there's a lot of opportunity to move things along pretty quickly if they're not responding. In addition to the basal bolus dose, which is the total daily dose, the patient will also have a correctional scale. So this is for hyperglycemia. This is above and beyond the basal bolus. So in addition to basal bolus, they're going to get correctional. Now, we might have called this in the past a sliding scale. It's really not a sliding scale. It's meant to be supplemental insulin to the basal bolus. So where do we start this correctional scale? Well, it's very similar to the total daily dose. We're going to start a patient on a low correctional scale if they take they're on less than 40 units of insulin a day. So when I say here TDD, that means total daily dose, less than 40 units. They're insulin naive, the same parameters really as the total daily dose parameters. They're frail, they're thin, elderly, their kidneys aren't working too good. We'll start them on a moderate correctional insulin scale if they're heavier and if their total daily dose is 40 to 80 units and they've got good PO intake. We're going to start them on the resistant correctional insulin scale if they're on more than 80 units of insulin a day, obese, steroids, or septic. So I just want to say something very important. Suppose we start a patient on a total daily dose of insulin that's low. And so we just want to cover the food and the background insulin with that. But what if their blood sugars start going high? So maybe we started them on low total daily dose and low correctional, but their blood sugars are running high. We could actually keep them on the low total daily dose, but bump them up on their correctional to moderate to cover that hyperglycemia. So we can move around in this correctional insulin. We could leave the basal bolus the same, but increase or decrease correctional insulin if they're getting hyper or hypoglycemia. So this gives us a lot of flexibility in adjusting insulin therapy. For an excellent sample of a basal bolus order set, click on this link to the Inpatient Management of Hyperglycemia and Diabetes article. Within that article, there's a protocol for basal bolus therapy that you can adapt for your work setting. Let's take a look at Mrs. Jones. She's an inpatient and she's 62 years old. She's a little bit heavy and she's feeling tired and urinating several times a night. She comes into the hospital and she has a UTI. If you look at her labs, her white count is elevated and her blood sugar is definitely above the diagnostic threshold of 200. It's 237, a random glucose. She is hypertensive with a history of gestational diabetes, no ketones in her urine. Her A1C is definitely elevated above the diagnostic criteria of 6.5 at 8.9%. So just from this information, we have a lot of good information about Mrs. Jones. We know she's had hyperglycemia for a while. She's probably had diabetes for a while. And she's not going to be that happy to find out that she, in addition to having a urinary tract infection, now has diabetes on top of it. Plus, we're going to need to start Mrs. Jones on some insulin to get those blood sugars to goal. So the next slide we're going to discuss, what insulin dose would we start Mrs. Jones on? With Mrs. Jones, even though she is older, she certainly is not a frail elderly person. She's not obese, and she has a good oral intake. Her A1C is 8.9, so we know she's had hyperglycemia for some time. So based on this, we're going to start her on a moderate insulin sensitivity. Now the moderate sensitivity says that we're going to start her on 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day. And it's using the 50-50 rule. So let's just take a look at this 50-50 rule. And what it says is that we're going to start the basal insulin. It's going to be 50% of the total daily dose, as we've mentioned before. And that could look like glargine at bedtime or MPH or Dedamir twice a day. The other 50% will be her bolus, or rapid-acting insulin, usually divided into 3 meals. So let's give an example. This patient weighs 50 kilograms, and we'll say since she's on the moderate insulin sensitivity, we're going to start at 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day. So 50 kilograms times 0.5 equals 25 units of insulin a day. But you can't give that all at one shot. 50% of it's basal. So what's 25 divided in half? Well, it's 13, and it's really 12.5, but we're going to round up on the basal dose. And on your power plans, it actually rounds down. So this would be 12 units. But we'll just say for this example right now, 13 units. 13 units at bedtime of glargine or Lantus, or maybe we divide it twice a day with MPH or Dedamir. The other half is a bolus insulin dose. So half of 25 is about 12, so 12 units for the bolus dose. And we have to divide that by 3 meals. So if you take 12 divided by 3 meals, that means 4 units per meal. So that is how you calculate basal bolus insulin. You take their body weight times their sensitivity, which in this case is a usual, so 50 kilograms times 0.5 with a total daily dose of 25 units. Half of that's basal, and the other half of that is bolus. And the bolus is divided by 3 meals. I'd like to give you an opportunity to think through this. Let's say Mrs. Jones actually weighs 60 kilograms. She's still going to be on the usual scale, so we do the 60 times 0.5. What I'd like you to do is just for a moment to calculate what you think her insulin needs would be, and maybe you can put this presentation on pause and then press play again when you're ready to review the answers. All right, so let's go over the answers. 60 times 0.5 is 30 units a day. 50% of that is assigned to basal, which would be 15 units, and it might look like 15 units of glargine at bedtime or in the morning, or we might split it up into 2 doses using MPH or Dedamir. The bolus dose is the other 15 units. Since we have to divide that by 3 meals, that would equal 5 units of Novolog, Apidra, or Humalog, or regular, each meal. So again, that's basal bolus therapy, and this is using the usual scale, 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day. So for this patient, Mr. R, here is a sensitive correction bolus. In addition to covering for meals or prandial insulin, he'll also receive additional insulin if his blood sugar is greater than 150. But you can see how conservative this scale is. It actually is very similar to the nighttime scale. So starting at 151 to 201 unit and one additional unit for 50 points above that. So this takes into account this patient, based on his weight and his sensitivity to insulin, really doesn't need a big blast of insulin, just a small additional units to help get blood glucose to goal. Let's take a look at 4 days of hospitalization with Mrs. Jones. And if you would like to pause the slideshow right now and just have a minute to look at the patterns and the insulin and draw some conclusions on your own, that might be a good time to do that. Otherwise, I'll just keep working with through this slide with you to kind of show what are some of the issues that might arise during this hospital stay. Based on her body weight, we're going to be giving her 5 units per meal of bolus insulin, and in addition, we'll give her the correction scale. the moderate correction scale, plus she gets 15 units of Lantus at bedtime. Let's take a look at 4 days and see what her blood sugars are doing. We don't have a blood sugar on admission, but we can see here at lunch her blood sugar is 219. Based on that, we give her the 5-unit meal bolus plus the 4 units of correction for a total of 9 units. So 9 units is a pretty hefty dose, but you can see at dinner time, we don't meet our target of blood sugar less than 140. That's a real strong sign to me that she has an infection or there's some other bodily stress that's happening, and she may be really insulin deficient. Her blood sugar actually went up after 9 units. So she's 243, and based on that, we give her the 5 units plus 4 units of correction, another 9 units. We're going to look at her blood sugars at bedtime, and when the target is less than 180. Her blood sugar is close to that, but it's a little bit high still at 219. At 219, when she's going to bed, we're going to give her that 15 units of Lantus basal insulin at nighttime. Now, we know that the basal insulin is reflected in the morning blood sugars, how well it's working. So let's take a look at morning right now. The goal for the morning is less than 140, but more than 70. We're right on the money at 129. So that's terrific. At 129, we give her 5 units, but no correction scale is required because she's not greater than 150. Then you can see at lunch, she doesn't reach target. She goes up to 197 when we were really trying to get her less than 140. So she gets that 5 units plus 2 units of correction. And at dinner time, she's 184 and requires another 7 units. But I just want to point out one thing. If you look at day 1 versus day 2, even though on day 2 we're still above target, you can see there's just a general trend on her blood sugar decreasing and her insulin needs decreasing. Very common when patients receive antibiotics, fluid, insulin. Over time, you'll see their blood sugar needs going down. Now, this is interesting. The goal for bedtime is less than 180. She's a little bit high, 195, but she's NPO. She's going for a procedure in the morning. So the nurse is kind of in a quandary. She's wondering, or he or she, should I give the whole 15 units of Lantus at bedtime or should I give less, or should I hold it, or what should I do? But the nurse on duty goes ahead and gives the 15 units of Lantus at bedtime, and we'll be talking about this. How do we modify insulin therapy for patients who are going to be NPO overnight and through the morning? But let's see what happened. Her blood sugar is 67, so indeed she's low. In the morning, the goal is more than 70. She's 67, and now she's NPO, so we're kind of stuck. We can't give her any oral fluids, and she's going for a procedure or surgery maybe. So we're going to hold the insulin, we're going to treat her for hypoglycemia, and we're going to make sure we have an IV of D5 or D10 to maintain her blood sugars during her procedure. So they come, they grab her, they wheel her away to her procedure, and she's gone during lunch. And when she comes back to the floor, we're kind of nervous about her blood sugars, so we check right away, and her blood sugars are fine at 119. She's on clear liquid, she's getting carbohydrates, she's not vomiting, so we feel comfortable giving her that 5 units of bolus insulin to cover the clear liquids. And we can see that was the right choice because at nighttime, her blood sugar is 104. Now, 104 is on the low side. Our goal for bedtime is less than 180, but we really like it greater than 110 for anyone on insulin therapy. So this gives us information that we're going to need to give this patient a snack. If it's Jell-O, maybe it's another, juice, a clear juice, so we can make sure she doesn't get hypoglycemic during the night. Now, the other question is, do we give her the Lantus? And yes, we're going to give her the 15 units of Lantus because she is no longer NPO. She's eating. She needs that background or basal insulin. Let's see what happens the next morning, because as you know, how well basal works is reflected in the morning blood sugars. Her morning blood sugar is 73. So it's within our goal range, but it's a little bit on the low side. So it's giving us information right now that maybe 15 units of Lantus is too much for her. And if she was to stay another day, I certainly would call the provider and say, can we reduce the Lantus insulin? And we can consider decreasing it maybe by 10% or 4 units, whatever is greater. That's one model that you could use. But your institution will have its own guidelines. at blood sugar of 73, she's going to eat. So we're going to give her the 5 units of bolus insulin. And let's see what happens at lunch. She's 81. That's within our target range. Less than 140, more than 70. But you can see she may need less insulin than what we're currently giving her if we were to follow her for a few more days. Then her blood sugar at dinner is 119, so right on the money. We give her 5 units of insulin, and she's going to go home. So we'll talk about, as she gets ready for discharge, what insulin therapy will we send her home on, and what instruction might we provide for her. In preparation for surgery, our patients with diabetes need special precautions because they might have insulin on board and they're an NPO status. So that can increase the risk for hypoglycemia. To prevent that, we're going to try and schedule the surgery in the morning, and then we can resume the medications and insulin post-surgical when they're stable and eating. If your patients are on oral medications for some reason during the hospital stay, what we say is the morning of the procedure, hold all oral medications and resume when the patient's stable. If your patients are on basal insulins, definitely the night before, we may consider decreasing that nighttime dose of basal insulin, and that would be dependent on what the morning blood sugars are running overall. But certainly, for type 2s, we would cut back on the usual morning basal dose by 50%, and we might cut back the night before by 50%. For type 1s, we will still give 100% of the basal dose, but we have a little precaution on the bolus insulin. So for bolus insulin, which is a fast-acting insulin, we may go to a very mild scale, a sensitive scale, and give very mild coverage for our type 1s and our type 2s if we're concerned about hyperglycemia. And certainly for anybody in an NPO situation who has insulin on board, we're going to have D5 or D10 IV bags available in case of low blood sugar. As you know, insulin will always lower blood sugar. It is a powerful hormone, and it can bring blood glucose to goal, but sometimes it can also make blood sugars go too low. So when we're looking at our patients' profiles and we're seeing that they're getting blood sugars in the 70s or below, we're going to have to start doing some critical thinking to reveal what is causing this low blood sugar. Because if we don't make some changes, this patient is at high risk for hypoglycemia in the future. So some possible causes, and the most common cause I see is too much insulin. So they might be getting too much insulin before the meals. Their bolus insulin might be too much. So you could tell that because their before next meal blood sugars are running too low. Or if their blood sugars are low in the morning, that means they're getting too much bedtime basal insulin. So we identify where the low is happening. We identify, is it being caused by the bolus insulin before meals or the nighttime insulin? Once we have identified it, we're going to contact the provider and see if we can't make some adjustments in insulin. The goal with insulin therapy is to give the least amount of insulin to get blood sugars to goal. We don't want to over-insulinize patients. So during that hospital stay, we may need to make adjustments in insulin therapy because the glucose toxicity improves. When blood sugars are 300, you need a lot more insulin. When blood sugars are 150, you may need less. Same thing with infection, or maybe they were on steroids and they're doing a steroid taper. We need to decrease the insulin dose associated with that steroid taper. If our patients come in and they have poor kidney function, we rehydrate them, we'll notice that they actually may have improving blood sugar levels. Their blood sugars might go a little bit higher. But if their kidney function is diminishing, which, well, I'll just say in a different way, if their creatinine starts creeping up, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, we know their kidneys are not effectively clearing used insulin, so they may need less insulin to prevent hypoglycemia. If our patients are nauseated or they have poor PO intake, we're going to need to be thoughtful about our insulin. And as I've mentioned before, if patients are nauseated or throwing up, we may actually dose the insulin after meals based on how much they ate. And this comes in, again, with saying some of our patients may not be able to get enough carbohydrates in to match the insulin. So the main point of this slide is if blood sugars are running low, yes, we're going to treat it. But even more than treating that low blood sugar, we're going to think backward and think, why did that patient get a low? and look for patterns, and then we're going to fix what's causing the low so it doesn't happen again in the future. And I know we're all busy, and I know there's lots of patients that you're juggling, but this low blood sugar is such an important issue. We really would appreciate, you know, the time that goes into really reflecting on those blood glucose levels and figuring out how to prevent low blood sugar in the future. Part of our teaching with our patients on the inpatient side is to let them know the signs of low blood sugar. So that way we develop a partnership. We tell the patient, if you're having any signs of low blood sugar, let me know right away. And you may want to consider putting a carbohydrate source by their bed, whether it's a juice, a snack, something that if they do feel low, they can contact you, but they don't have to delay in receiving the treatment they need to get their blood sugar up. Patients, I always ask patients, what are your signs of low blood sugar? And even if you don't have diabetes, most of us know our signs of low. I'm cranky. Some people get, you know, anxious, fast heart rate, trembling. So we're going to help them identify their signs of low. And if they have family members there, we're going to go over that with their family members too. As you really move into neuroglycopenia, which means you're not getting enough energy to your brain, then it really affects cognition and ability to speak, ability to critically think, and these patients may not be able to identify that they're low. So we want to catch them early on and provide treatment when they're here in this autonomic situation where they're having that adrenaline rush. Because there they still have clear thinking and they can treat that low blood sugar and prevent going into severe hypoglycemia. Now, if the blood glucose is too low, we need to make some adjustments in insulin. So if the before meal blood glucose is less than 70, we're going to implement the hypoglycemia protocol, and that will be different for everyone's institution, but the basic formula is give carbohydrate 15 grams, recheck in 15 minutes, and make sure this patient's blood sugar is at a safe place. And then we're going to have to make some evaluations and figure out what caused it. What do we need to adjust? Did this patient miss a meal? Is there too much insulin? Do we need to rethink our therapy and our dosing? Very important. If we don't fix it, it's going to continue to happen. Now, morning blood glucose less than 90. Your institution may have a different threshold, so maybe you say less than 70 or less than 80, but any blood glucose in the morning less than 90 gives us cause to consider, should we back off on the evening Lantus? Maybe it's just too much Lantus at night. Let's err on the side of safety. Let's reduce that dose by maybe 4 units or 10%. Whatever your institution calls for. But this really does require action. If we don't take action, that patient is at risk for morning hypoglycemia in the future. We're always going to evaluate our trends, provide feedback. This is a dynamic situation. Insulin dose isn't just you do it once and it's right. We need to adjust over time based on what the patient's blood sugar is doing, based on their health status, and based on their eating. Based on a lot of different factors, the insulin dose will need to be modified in response to the patient's blood sugars. To prevent nighttime hypoglycemia, for all the different sensitivities to insulin, there is one bedtime correction bolus for all levels. And this is a very conservative insulin treatment plan to help prevent nighttime hypoglycemia. You can see that it starts at blood sugar of 151 to 200, just one unit. And then it goes on adding one unit for every 50 above target. So it's a very conservative insulin dose so that patients don't experience nocturnal hypoglycemia. So regardless of the insulin sensitivity, this schedule is used for all patients at nighttime. As we've mentioned earlier, treating hypoglycemia is very important. If the blood glucose is 70 or less and the patient is eating, we're going to give them a carbohydrate source, whether it's gel, glucose tabs, whatever you use in your institution. But if the blood glucose is 70 or less and the patient is not eating, we have to take different action. And we're going to give the patient D50 if there's IV access, or if there's no IV access, we're going to have to give glucagon, and glucagon is an intramuscular or sub-Q injection, and what it does, it's a hormone that tells the liver to release its stored glucose. So glucagon is an injection that helps liberate stored glycogen in the liver. Either way, we're going to have to recheck that blood glucose every 15 minutes. We're going to hold the next correction insulin dose because we want to make sure we don't get into hypoglycemia again. And we're going to give next meal insulin, and we're going to give the Lantus dose at nighttime. So we're going to give the patient a little break from their insulin, but give it to them next meal and make sure we give the Lantus dose, of course. Unless that, you know, if that blood sugar is 70 in the morning, we're going to decrease the Lantus dose. If it's running less than 70 during meal times, we'll decrease the bolus dose. Now, Mrs. Jones is improved and ready to go home. What glucose management strategies are we going to use for her at home? Her admission A1C, as you remember, is 8.9. So we know before she came into the hospital, her blood sugars had been elevated for the last 3 months. This discharge insulin algorithm has been developed by the American College of Endocrinology and the American Diabetes Association in their hospital guidelines. So your hospital might use something different, but I think this is a very excellent starting place for figuring out, based on the admission A1C, how should we discharge patients? Let's start over here. So if the A1C is less than 7%, which means that patient probably has either well-controlled diabetes or new-onset diabetes for a short period of time, we're going to restart the outpatient treatment. So whatever they came in on, then we're going to start them on, resume them on what they were doing before they came into the hospital. But what if they're new to diabetes? Well, the provider is going to have to figure out, based on their hospital blood glucose, would it be best to discharge them on oral medications? And I would vote for that, given that the blood sugars are really not very high at all. With the A1C less than 7, they're at target range for A1C. So probably this patient can go home on oral medications. Let's take a look at this. What if the A1C is 7 to 9%, and that's where Mrs. Jones is at? We're going to restart outpatient oral agents and DC glargine once daily at 50 to 80% of hospital dose. So what we're going to say here is let's get them back on their oral agents if they were on some, so we can consider oral agents for Mrs. Jones. But the other thing we could say is let's discharge them on 50 to 80% of their hospital dose of glargine or long-acting insulin. So if they were on 20 units of Lantus at night, we would say, well, let's send them home on 10 units and maybe some metformin or oral agents and see if they can't get their blood sugars under control. So that's what that means. What if the A1C is greater than 9%? Well, we know that they're really running high blood glucose levels. They need some help with their diabetes management. So what they recommend is let's send them home on the basal bolus that they were on in the hospital. Or we could restart oral agents and send them home on their glargine at Orlantis or basal insulin at about 50 to 80% of the dose that was used in the hospital. So this is just a real nice, I think, discharge algorithm to help us figure out how to discharge people safely. And as I've mentioned before, once we treat people and we get their infection fixed or whatever brought them into the hospital and their stress state is resolving, they generally need less insulin. So we need to consider that too as they are discharged. I went to a presentation by this by the Dr. Umpietas, who I have listed here as a resource, and he was saying that was one of the things they're really struggling with is after discharge, if they send patients home on the basal bolus they were in the hospital, they're really struggling with hypoglycemia post-discharge. So they came up with this algorithm to improve outpatient safety and make sure patients are receiving a management that matches their blood glucose levels. So thinking about discharge teaching for Mrs. Jones, and we'll just go over this very briefly, but what supplies will she need? Well, she's certainly going to need a glucose meter. She's going to need to know what, and if she goes home on insulin, she'll need insulin syringes and insulin supplies. What top three things do we need to teach her? Well, we're going to need to teach her how to check her blood sugars. We're going to need to teach her what those blood sugar numbers mean. So what is the target for her? And we can use the same targets as in the hospital, which is blood sugar 70. Well, we have a little bit different at the home setting, but 70 to 130 before meals, less than 180 after a meal. But never less than 70. What resources can we provide? Well, certainly we're going to make sure during the hospital stay, she sees a dietitian. We're going to, if there's a diabetes educator, we can make sure that that resource is made available to her. And also, we're going to reach out to the community and see in our community, do they have diabetes support group, outpatient classes, and within our own institutions, maybe we can refer to dietitians, outpatient diabetes educators, and making sure she has a primary care provider that she can follow up with and that can help her, you know, manage her diabetes and her other comorbidities on a more preventive basis. Discharge teaching ideally starts on admission. Hospitals are busy places. It's hard to get in and find that time to do teaching. So I really encourage people, if you can, to do on-the-spot teaching when it's a natural teaching moment. For example, can the patient perform self-blood glucose monitoring? So while we're checking their blood sugar, maybe you can ask the patient, can you show me how you poke your finger? How do you get the blood? What kind of meter do you have? Is the meter working well? Do you even have a meter? Do you need one? And how do you access meters in your hospitals? And then we're going to ask the patient, what is your blood sugar goal? Find out. So we can do a lot while we're waiting for that blood sugar result, while we're poking the finger. And we can engage the patient in that activity, and it doesn't take us a lot of extra time. Another very important question is, does the patient know what meds they're on for their diabetes? Do they know what that little pink pill does? Do they know that sulfonylureas can cause low blood sugar? Do they know how to inject their insulin? Do they know where to dispose of their needles? So while we're giving insulin to the patient, we can have them practice drawing it up, injecting it, talking about disposal. Natural teaching moments help us be efficient and feel like we're not overwhelmed with our responsibilities. We can ask a patient, do they know their signs of low blood sugar? So I simply say to my patients, tell me how you felt when your blood sugar was low. All of us know that feeling. They can then identify their signs of low blood sugar, and then we'll say, what did you do to treat it? And then we'll give them instruction on that. And we also want to make sure they know the signs when their blood sugar is too high. I'm always going to ask the patient, do you know the signs? Have you ever experienced this before? Because if they can pull it from personal experience, they're more likely to remember it and apply that information. So important is a follow-up plan. Our patients in the hospital are sick. They may not be able to assimilate all the information we're sharing with them. They may be overwhelmed. Do they have a plan for follow-up? Does this mean home health? Do they have a provider appointment? Do they have an appointment with a dietitian or the diabetes education team? And very important, do they know who to contact when they need help? This is so important. Who do you call if your blood sugars are too high and too low? And do they know what that means? What does it mean when they need help? Does that mean their blood sugars are 200 or greater times 2, or they have one blood sugar less than 70? Well, you'll need to define that with the person. But those are some good getting started parameters when patients should call for help. If a person doesn't know when to call for help, they don't reach out. So you really, really want to make sure they have a clear notion of when and who to contact. All right, let's take a look at Mr. R. Mr. R has pneumonia. How much insulin will he need? What sensitivity factor will we use for him? Let's take a look at his creatinine. It's 1.6. He's 76 years old. He's really not very hungry. You can see he's lean with a BMI of 22 and a weight of 70 kilograms. At home, he takes Glucotrol 5 milligrams a day. And Glucotrol is a sulfonylurea that tells your pancreas to make more insulin. And his A1C is 7.2. So that tells us his blood sugars are close to goal. The A1C goal is less than 7. And then a lot of our older patients, we kind of relax that goal. And the ADA is now saying maybe even less than 8 is appropriate for some of our patients. But just based on this information, I want you to think, what insulin sensitivity factor should we put him on? Should we put him on the sensitive one, the usual, or the more resistant, aggressive insulin scale? So think about that for a minute, and then we'll go to our next slide. Well, based on his body weight and his A1C and his age and his creatinine, we're going to put him on the sensitive scale. The sensitive scale says this patient needs 0.3 units of insulin per kilogram per day. So let's just do a calculation and figure out how much insulin would this patient need for the total day, and then go ahead and figure out for the basal dose and the bolus dose. And go ahead and put me on pause and then calculate your answers, and then you can hit play again when you come up with your answers. All right, let's go over the answers. So if we take 70 kilograms times 0.3, that's 21 units of insulin per day. So we're going to divide that now 50-50, 50% basal and 50% bolus. So what's half of 21? Well, it's 10.5. So when we're just doing it in our head, I usually assign the basal dose with a little bit more insulin because it's less likely to cause hypoglycemia. So we're just going to say 11 units of basal insulin, which might be glargine at bedtime, or we might give it in the morning, or we might use a different type of basal insulin like MPH or Denimer. So the remaining insulin is 10 units. So the 10 units now will be divided by 3 meals. And again, you can't divide 10 by 3 and come up with a whole number. So we're just going to round it and make it 3 units of Novolog-Apidra or Humalog or even regular with each meal. And this is using the 50-50 rule or basal bolus insulin dosing strategy for a person who's really insulin sensitive. This table lists the usual correction bolus. This is a bolus a patient would get in addition to their mealtime insulin if their blood sugars are greater than 150. And here, as the example I showed you earlier, it starts at 151 to 200, they get an additional 1 unit. And it goes up every 50 point increase in blood glucose. We add additional insulin to help bring the blood sugars down. So the correction bolus is added to the prandial bolus before each meal. And this correction bolus is determined by the provider when they set up the order set. Now, what about this patient if he has 3 days of poor intake, Mr. R? So he's just really not eating that good. He has bad dentition. He doesn't really feel like eating. He's a little bit nauseated. So we start him on a tube feeding. So this happens all the time. Patients come in, they're older, they're frail, they're underweight, and they really need some nutrition. So what would we do differently if we started him on continuous tube feeding? How would this change his insulin regimen? Basal bolus doesn't work if you're eating on an ongoing basis because there's no time when you're not eating. You're continually getting a glucose source. So we'll answer this in a minute, but I just want to have you all think about this. Now, what if we do intermittent tube feeding? How would this change his insulin regimen? So what if we said every 4 or every 6 hours he gets a tube feeding? In that situation, we could still use basal bolus because we could say every time he gets his tube feeding, give him some bolus insulin, and we might give him some basal one time a day just to help get blood sugars under control between meals. Between feedings. If patient's tube feeding is interrupted, what precautions would you take? Okay, this is very important. What if a patient is on a tube feeding and all of a sudden they pull out their NG tube? This has happened to all of us a million times. So he has insulin on board. You gave him, some bolus insulin, let's just say 6 units, and now he's pulled out his tube feeding. He's getting no energy, no glucose is flowing into his intestines, so we know he's at risk for hypoglycemia. And in this situation, we're going to make sure he has D5 or D10 running to interact with that insulin that's on board. This next slide will go over this in more detail. So for patients on enteral nutrition therapy, we have to strategize a little bit differently. And this is from the American Diabetes Association and American College of Endocrinology. And what they say, if the patient's on a continuous enteral nutrition, they're just getting fed 24 hours a day, we're still going to calculate their basal bolus rate based on their sensitivity and their body weight. And then we're going to say, let's give 50% of it basal, but you're going to split up that basal and give it twice daily. The prandial insulin or bolus insulin, which is the other 50%, we're going to divide into 4 doses and give it every 6 hours. So that patient has ongoing continuous basal bolus coverage. If they're on cycled enteral nutrition, so we might be just, you know, cycling it. They might be receiving it at night, and during the day they're off of it. We're going to, again, do a combination of basal bolus insulin given at the start of each tube feeding. So you might even try those pre-mixed insulins, the 70-30, given at the start of each tube feeding. Or what we could do is we could give bolus insulin 4 to 6 hours, every 4 to 6 hours, for the duration of the nutrition administration. So right before we hang a bag, we'll give them some bolus insulin, and we'll do that every 4 to 6 hours. In addition to the bolus insulin, if they're on this cycled enteral nutrition, we're going to give correctional insulin for blood sugars above goal. If they're on the bolus enteral nutrition feeding and they're getting it every 6 hours, we're just going to give bolus or rapid-acting insulin prior to each tube feeding session. In addition, you could just try the bolus insulin, but many people will also need the basal insulin, background insulin, to cover in between meals in addition to the bolus. So you can see there's not one black and white way of doing this. We're going to have to match the insulin to the patient, but we could still use our basic formulation of saying, you know, 0.3 to 0.7 units of insulin per kilogram. We'll divide it between basal and bolus and administer it based on when the patient is receiving their nutrition therapy, whether it's continuous or whether it's cycled or whether it's just bolus nutrition. So we're going to match the insulin to the patient's needs. Let's take a look at Mr. R's blood glucose patterns over 6 days of hospitalization. We know he's getting 3-unit meal bolus, which is a rapid insulin or fast acting, plus mild correction, and he's going to receive 11 units of Lantus at bedtime. On admission, his blood sugar is high. It's 381. So we give him that 3-unit meal bolus plus the correction of 5 for a total of 8 units. And he really responds to this. His bedtime blood sugar comes down to 198 with a target of less than 180. So he's very close. We give him the 11 units of HS Lantus, and let's take a look at his morning blood sugars. Right on target. So that gives us information that 11 units of Lantus is about the right amount for him to get his morning blood sugars to target without going too low. So we give him 3 units to cover his carbs, and that worked out great because before lunch he reaches his target at 127. We give him 3 units, but we see at pre-dinner he goes too low. Now when I see this happening, I have information now to know that 3 units is probably the right dose for him, because at breakfast, even with a 98 blood sugar, he took 3. His pre-lunch blood sugar was 127. So this tells me maybe he didn't have enough carbohydrate intake at lunch. Maybe he's not eating that well. So what happened is the nurse went ahead, held the insulin, initiated the hypoglycemia protocol, made sure he ate, you know, checked his blood sugars 15 minutes later. And then you can see again, she checked it, he or she checked it at bedtime. And by bedtime, the blood sugar is 98. At this point, the nurse decided to hold the Lantus. However, there is no indication to hold the Lantus when the bedtime blood sugar is 98. That blood sugar is right at target. We hold Lantus if morning blood sugars are too low. So Lantus, we hold it for low morning blood sugars. We don't hold it if the bedtime blood sugar is 98. So that's just really important to kind of keep an eye on. If the blood sugar at bedtime is too low, it's a reflection of what happened at dinner. So we would adjust the dinner insulin. But overall, I can see this patient, since he didn't get any insulin at dinner, is just probably not eating that well. Blood sugar in the morning is 137. It's still close to target, and we give him, it's actually at target, less than 140, but it's a little bit higher than the previous day. We give him 3 units of insulin, and again, he drops to 67. At this point, we hold the insulin, we initiate the hypoglycemia protocol, and the provider says, let's start him on some tube feeding. He's just not eating enough. So the tube feeding starts. Now this is, what we're going to do is 4 times a day. So he's going to get a tube feeding, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and bedtime. In this situation, what the provider decided to do is go ahead and use the usual meal bolus and correction scale with the tube feeding. So to give him the 3 units plus any additional insulin for hyperglycemia. So at bedtime, his blood sugar is 207. So they're going to give him the 3 units plus the 1 unit correction factor for a total of 4 units. In this situation, they still decided to keep him on the Lantus insulin, so he got the 11 units of Lantus at bedtime. He woke up with a blood sugar of 142. So we go ahead and give him his 3 units, meal bolus, and no correction is needed at this point. Then, at lunch, we checked the blood sugar. It was 129, so they gave him 3 units, but the patient pulled the tube. So now you have a situation where he has insulin on board, but there's no nutrition going in. And by the time the nurse gets to check the blood sugar again, it's dinner time, and the patient feels funny. Blood sugar 63. So anytime the patient is given insulin and they pull their NG tube, they're not getting that energy source, we're going to have to be very vigilant and see, can he drink some juice? You know, can he get anything down to help prevent his blood sugar from going too low? And as you can see, the insulin was held. Again, we did the hypoglycemia protocol, and they were not able to get the tube feeding back in. They just were trying to encourage the patient to eat. So at bedtime that night at 184, he went ahead and received his 11 units of Lantus. So when I look at this patient profile, the thing I'm always worried about is preventing low blood sugar. And this patient seems like a little bit older, more frail, needs a lot more vigilance as far as his blood sugar and his glucose management, especially if we're not sure about his nutritional intake. So one thing we could always consider for patients in this situation is give the insulin after meals based on how much they eat. That is a strategy that we can use for patients who are not always sure about the nutritional intake. So that is one thing we can do. We can never predict a tube feeding being pulled, but if it is pulled, we can have preventive measures in hand, like seeing if the patient can have some juice, make sure he has IV access if he can't eat, so we can give him maybe some D5, so he has some carbohydrate on board. All right, let's keep going. So our patient's getting ready to go home, Mr. R, and we need to think about a discharge treatment for him. We know that his A1C when he came in was 7 to 9%. It was just barely above 7. So what they say here is to restart his outpatient oral agents. So that would be the glyburide that he was on. We could restart that, and we know that was seemed to be getting him to goal, but certainly any patient going home on glyburide would need to be counseled about the signs of low blood sugar. This patient, I don't think, would need the Lantus or long-acting basal insulin at night. He's kind of frail elderly, so we'd be very conservative on what we sent him home on. So in this situation, since his A1C is so close to target, we may discharge him just on his oral agent. So after 9 days, he does go home, and he's regaining his strength. And what's going to be your glucose management strategy? We talked about that. We'll send him home on his oral agent. What supplies will he need? Well, hopefully he has a meter, but if he doesn't, he's going to need one. And he'll need to know how to log his blood sugars and when to check his blood sugars. So this is very important too. When does he need to check his blood sugars? Well, I would have him rotate. I would have him check once a day in the morning when he wakes up. Very important to prevent that nocturnal hypoglycemia. And then the other day I have him check before he goes to bed to make sure it's above 100 when he goes to sleep. We definitely need to teach him the signs of low blood sugar and who to call for help if he feels sick or he's not eating or if his blood sugar goes too low or too high. And again, the resources and referrals, we're going to reach out to our hospital services and our community and make sure he has an appointment with his primary care provider, his diabetes educator, his dietitian, and he feels like he's connected to a system. We don't want Mr. R to get lost between the cracks, because a lot of frail elderly really struggle with the pharmacology of diabetes, with management, and they may have a hard time keeping all of the medications straight. So we want to make sure that he's also hooked up with a pharmacy, and he goes to one pharmacy to receive all of his medications so that the pharmacist can counsel him if he's combining medications maybe he shouldn't combine.
At discharge, we're going to consider, again, the 4 discharge questions. Is a patient safe at performing self-blood glucose monitoring? Do they know what the numbers mean? And do they have the supplies necessary to check their blood sugars? Do they understand their medications and how to take them safely, the dosing, what time of day, and the side effects? If the patient experiences low or high blood sugar, do they know the action to take? And so importantly, do they know who to contact if they need help or if their blood sugars are out of goal range? Okay, here we have a new patient who's come into the hospital, and we're going to try and figure out how much insulin is needed. And you could say, well, this is really obvious. This gentleman has a lot of extra weight around his middle, and he's probably insulin resistant. So yes, we definitely know that visceral adiposity increases insulin resistance and increases the need for insulin. This gentleman's waistline is 46. His creatinine is 0.9. He has an infected foot ulcer. He has asthma, and he's on medications for diabetes that include metformin. Exenatide, he ran out. So exenatide is a gut hormone imitator. It's called an incretin mimetic. And you take it twice a day to help lower your blood sugars. It's an injection. So whenever a patient says, I ran out, we know that maybe he's not really great at follow-up with his medications. He's on Actos, which is a medication that increases insulin sensitivity, and it can also cause fluid retention. So he's really worried about his ankle swelling, and his ankles are really swollen, and he looks like he's in fluid overload. And so he's probably stopped taking his Actos. His A1C is not where we want it to be, at 10.8. The goal is less than 7 if you have your diabetes well managed. So you can see this man is really struggling with his diabetes. He's got some other chronic conditions. He comes in with an infection and asthma. And maybe even on his asthma, he might need some steroids. So we're kind of predicting that this gentleman is going to need quite a bit of insulin to get his blood glucose levels to where they need to be. So based on this gentleman's body weight and presentation, the provider decides to start him on the more aggressive scale, the insulin resistance scale, which is the 0.7 units of insulin per kilogram per day. And let's just imagine he weighs 100 kilograms, and what I'd like you to do is to fill out the blanks here, and then we can go over each one of these and see how the answers. And you can check your answers along with the next slide. So go ahead and put me on pause so you can rejoin me after you calculate this out. In this situation, if we look at somebody who's insulin resistant, you could see their insulin needs are much higher than the insulin sensitive patient. And this example was 100 kilogram body weight times 0.7, which gives us a total of 70 units of insulin that this patient needs per day. Again, half of it's assigned to basal, so we came up with 35 units of basal, and the other 35 units is bolus. How do we divide 35 into 3 meals? Well, in this situation, we just said 11 times 3, which would be 33, will be close enough. So this patient is requiring a lot of insulin every meal, 11 units, just for the prandial, and then we'll take a look at what his additional correctional dose will be. An upcoming slide, but you can see this patient is going to require a lot of insulin because he's insulin resistant, he's infected, and he's got other risk factors for needing high levels of insulin therapy. For this patient, in addition to getting that prandial bolus insulin with every meal, we're going to give him additional insulin if his blood sugar is above 150. Now, if you remember some of the other scales, they were much more mild than this. This one you can see is pretty aggressive. The blood sugar is 151 to 200. We give 3 units. And for every 50 points above, we add an additional 3 units. So we definitely know that when patients have higher blood sugars, they need more insulin to stop that glucose toxicity and bring their blood sugars to goal. So he's going to be requiring a lot of insulin. And this is just a general rule of thumb. The leaner patients are, the more insulin sensitive they are, the less insulin they need. As patients get heavier, they're more infected, they're on steroids, they need a lot more insulin. So patients really are on a continuum of insulin needs. And as they improve, as their health improves, their insulin needs might decrease. As we predicted, this patient is started on prednisone, 60 milligrams a day for asthma. So that's a pretty hefty dose. And now that he's on this prednisone, his blood sugars are really ramping up. He's in the 300 to 500 levels. And the provider and the staff are very concerned about this. They're like, this is way above our target ranges. We're trying hard. We're giving him, you know, the insulin resistant correction scale in addition to the usual prandial insulin. He's still running high. What is our next step? Well, we're going to investigate what could be causing this high blood glucose. So he could just be glucose toxic. There's so much glucose in his blood, we just haven't given him enough insulin to stop the glucose toxicity and get blood sugars to where they need to be. He has an infection in his foot, makes you very insulin resistant. Steroids make you insulin resistant, physical stress. And even though he's on this very aggressive insulin management therapy, it still may not be enough insulin to counteract all these other forces pushing the blood sugars up. When the blood glucose is too high, we're going to take a look at what could be causing it and look at making some adjustments to the insulin. If the morning blood glucose is 140 or greater, we're going to have to consider two major causes. Number one, could the patient be having nocturnal hypoglycemia? What this means is that they're getting low blood sugar in the middle of the night. And when you get nocturnal hypoglycemia, you release counter-regulatory hormones and glucagon that raise your blood sugar up. And that can cause morning hyperglycemia, or blood sugars greater than 140. You would need to investigate if this is happening by asking the patient, are you getting sweaty in the middle of the night? Are you waking up with a headache? Are you waking up hungry? If the patient is saying yes to this, we could suspect nocturnal hypo and we could check their 2 a.m. blood sugars. However, if they say no and they, you know, there's no signs of that, we could go on to consider that they're just not getting enough insulin. We know if the morning blood sugar is high, it's a reflection of not enough basal insulin. Fasting hyperglycemia is corrected by increasing the basal insulin. In this situation, this person is on Lantus, one of our basal insulins, so we can go ahead and increase the evening Lantus by 10%. If they were on a different type of basal, like MPH or Detemir, we would also increase that. We always want to go very gradual when we increase insulin, especially when we think about the risk of morning low. We're very conservative, so just gradually going up every few days is the best plan of action. But what if the pre-lunch blood sugar is higher than 140, or that post-meal blood sugar is higher than 180? How are we going to correct that? Well, we have two strategies to fix that. Number one, we can increase the prandial coverage. So we're going to take a look and see, are they getting enough insulin to cover the carbohydrates they're eating? So you could take a look at their carbs, see how much carbs, see how much insulin. Maybe that ratio is not right. So we can talk to the provider about increasing their prandial coverage. Or a little simpler approach that may be also very effective is just to increase their insulin correction scale. If they're on a mild scale, maybe we could say, let's bump them up to a moderate and keep them on the same prandial coverage. Or we could bump them up to a more aggressive scale. So these are our two choices. It's going to depend on your institution, how the patient is responding, and the provider's comfort level, which one of these happen. Regardless of what we do, we need to do something. We know that we want to get those morning blood sugars less than 140 and the pre-lunch and pre-dinner is less than 140 also. And we want to make sure that post-meal blood glucose is less than 180. And we're going to look here at changing insulin therapy to reach those goals. Let's take a look at Mr. K's blood glucose patterns and his response to insulin therapy. His first blood sugar comes in at 432. So he's going to get 11 unit meal bolus based on his body weight and also the high or resistant insulin correction scale. So that equals a total insulin of 11 plus 18 or 29 units. So for 29 units of insulin, we would hope that blood sugar would come down, and it does. It goes down to 182 at bedtime with our target range less than 180, so very close. If you notice, he doesn't get the Lantus at bedtime. He's scheduled for Lantus 35 units in the morning. When he wakes up, his blood sugar is above target at 292, so he gets 11 units of his usual meal bolus plus 9 for correction for a total of 20 units. Plus, he's going to get his Lantus. At lunch, his blood sugar is zooming up into the 400s. So he's way above target, and based on this blood sugar, he gets the 29 units. And you would think with 29 units on board, the blood sugar would really come down, but you can see how insulin resistant he is. His blood sugar is still hovering at 391. So in spite of very high doses of insulin, we're having a lot of trouble getting this blood sugar to goal range. Here's 26 units. Finally, his blood sugar at bedtime gets a little bit lower at 234. And based on the nighttime scale, he gets 1 unit. Let's see what he wakes up at. On day 3, he's 318. So clearly we're losing ground with insulin and his blood sugars. He's got the infection. He's got steroids. His blood sugars are really almost unmanageable at this point. So here we're going to give him 23 units. And at lunch, again, he's 497, we give him 29. At dinner, 408, we give him 29 units. And at bed, he finally gets under 400, and we give him 3-unit coverage. So finally, on this day 4, with the blood sugar of 423, we realize that we can no longer manage this blood sugar with basal bolus therapy. And an insulin drip is started when that blood sugar is 429 at lunch. Mr. K's blood glucose levels are too high to manage with basal bolus therapy, so he's transferred to a more intensive unit and an insulin drip is started. Guidelines recommend that we mix 100 units of insulin in a 100 cc normal saline bag. That way, 1 cc of fluid equals 1 unit of insulin, and this helps to decrease error rate. Each institution uses its own formulation to administer insulin drips, so look for your institution's protocol. However, on our resource page, we have listed articles and different examples of insulin drip protocols for your reference. Mr. K is having a lot of trouble managing his diabetes on the outpatient setting. So when we think about a discharge plan, we're really going to have an honest heart-to-heart talk with him to see what is realistic for him, given his life, given his barriers, given his belief about his diabetes. His A1C was greater than 9 on admission. Based on that, if you look at this algorithm, we're going to discharge him on the same basal bolus rate he was at the hospital. So after he gets off his insulin drip and he's back on basal bolus and his blood sugars are stabilized, that would be his discharge dose. However, in the hospital setting, we're checking blood sugars 4 times a day. We're giving insulin 3 to 4 times a day. Is that really realistic for this particular patient? We're going to have to evaluate that and see if we might have to simplify the regimen, get home health out there, and really work with him to make a program, an insulin management program, that is realistic for him. An alternative is to restart those oral agents and the injectables and DC on glargine once a day at 50 to 80% of the hospital dose. So that is another alternative we may discuss with him. Either way, this patient is going to need a lot of ongoing support and follow-up. In this situation, we definitely could send him home on the metformin. That's the pill. And the metformin is so helpful because it will help lower blood sugars, help with no weight gain, and certainly can help with cholesterol a little bit. The exenatide injection, we're going to have to do some real talking with him. It's a great medication for him because it does help people with weight loss and weight management, and it does lower blood glucose levels. So we'll have to see, is this something that's realistic for you? Will you take it on an ongoing basis if we send you home on it? On the Actos, we're going to have to, of course, the providers involved in all this decision making, but if this patient's getting swelling ankles and he's getting fluid retention, it might be leading or increasing his risk for CHF. So this may not be a good match for him. So we're going to have to evaluate all of this, but certainly whatever plan he was doing at home isn't working. So I think this patient is a very excellent candidate for going home on basal bolus therapy. Mr. K has a lot of different issues happening with him. So our biggest concern really is making sure that his foot ulceration heals. And that's going to require probably antibiotic therapy, offloading off of the wound. And he's going to really need to keep his blood glucose levels where they need to be. So this person is going to need a lot of coaching and support as he moves forward in becoming more actively involved with his diabetes self-care. He's going to need to make sure he has the supplies to check his blood sugars, to keep a log of that. And he's also going to really know when he should contact his provider and how to reach out for help if his blood sugars are not close to goal range. So we're going to make sure he knows how to check his blood sugar, what to do if the blood sugar levels are too high, and also we're going to really promote diabetes self-care. Resources and referrals are going to be very important for this gentleman. He has a lot of risk factors, so we're going to make sure to connect him to a diabetes education team, a dietitian, a provider. He might also benefit from some mental health counseling if he's having trouble coping with a lot of different chronic illnesses. He's a great candidate for a diabetes support group. So we're going to think in the long term with him, especially if we're thinking about a prednisone taper. As his prednisone levels come down, we're going to need to have a discussion with him that your insulin needs may decrease as your prednisone levels decrease. So kind of thinking forward with Mr. K and really helping him identify some of the issues he's struggling with and some workarounds for him that are reasonable and realistic. Coming back to our top four discharge questions for Mr. K, I think these are very important to go through with him, especially does he know how to treat hypo and hyperglycemia? And yes, does he know what to do on sick days? And does he know what to do if that wound isn't healing and his blood sugars are high and his asthma is getting worse? So does he know what to do when other health problems are really impacting his blood glucose levels? Mr. K is going to need a lot of support and ongoing encouragement. I want to thank you for joining this webinar. It's so important that patients see us working hard to get blood sugars to goal in the hospital setting. When they see us working hard, it inspires them to keep their blood sugars at goal range when they return to their home setting. So thank you for all the work that you're doing in your practice setting to improve inpatient glucose control. Some clinical resources that you might consider are these books published by the American Diabetes Association. We have them available on our website, and it helps expand on some of these key concepts we've discussed during this online course. As always, we want to thank you for joining our web clinic. Just some wrap-up notes. You have 1 year to complete this program and take the post-test to receive your CE credit from the time of purchase. All you have to do is complete the post-test, you click the button, and then complete the program survey. We always appreciate your feedback. Now your certificate is ready to print out, and you can always reprint a certificate from the transcript page. Please join us on Facebook. We have special events and coupon codes that we'd love to share with you. This is Beverly Tomasian thanking you and encouraging you to keep in touch. We have all kinds of free programs and resources on our website, so stop by and let us know how things are going.